March.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Today is Wednesday, June 7th, 2017. I'm opening a meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. At long last, the moment we've all been waiting for, we will be starting today to run the Oregon Health Authority budget. This is very different from any other budget you may have seen so far, so I'm going to ask Ms. Ames to update all of our committee members about how we're going to be proceeding for the next couple of days, along with the fact that we're going to be doing work sessions on a couple other bills. So, oh, how nice of you to show up, Representative Rayfield. Very kind of you. Very kind of you to grace us with your presence.
I'm just so happy that you're happy to see me.
I'm always happy to see you, my dear co-chair. So before we get started with specific work sessions, Ms. Ames, can you
don't
just
you
give
laugh,
us a...
laugh, Justin.
He's laughing.
I was early.
Okay, you want to get us started? Just give us a heads up about how it's going to work before we do the work session on 5027.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, so because OHA is so big and it takes at least 2 days to do, sometimes we've taken three, the way that we handle it is you have a little memo and work papers, although they're not actually out of the system like for other agencies, for each division rather than for the agency as a whole, so that you can see a little bit more detail into what's going on with each division. And then, as you'll see in your memo, we actually vote on the LFO recommendation as a preliminary recommendation to the budget for each division. And then on the at the end, so hopefully late tomorrow, we will have a display that shows all the different divisions and budgets that you've approved that far, and then we do a formal vote on the amendment that incorporates all those numbers together. And the two bills, the policy bills that we have today, are fee bills that directly relate to the public health budget. So we're doing them at the same time as we do that budget.
Okay. So I'm going to start by opening a work session on House Bill 5027. Ms. Ames.
Okay. Madam Chair, House Bill 5027 is the fee ratification bill for the Oregon Health Authority. It ratifies fees that were adopted administratively by the agency and then approved by the Department of Administrative Services during the interim. There is a statute that requires that when a fee is adopted administratively, that there is a formal ratification at the next legislative session in order for that fee to continue. In this particular bill, there are four new advanced technology laboratory accreditation fees which were established, which enable the Oregon Environmental Laboratory Accreditation Program, or what we usually call ORLAP, to accredit laboratories that test marijuana. In addition, the out-of-state fees for laboratories seeking accreditation were increased by 20%. Those were last increased in 2011. Fees were also established to fulfill the requirements of the 2015 Toxic-Free Kids Act, Senate Bill 478. Fees will be assessed on manufacturers and distributors of children's products sold in Oregon with annual worldwide sales of $5 million or more for disclosure of chemicals and for exemption requests. The fee increases in total are expected to generate about $882,000 in other fund revenues during the 17-19 biennium. The expenditure limitation for those fees is included in Package 409 in the public health budget. There is an amendment. The Dash 1 amendment modifies the wording on one of the fees to more accurately reflect how the fee actually works. It is not a change to the fee. It is simply to clarify more clearly that it's a per hour fee.
And before we get a motion, I just want to put a couple things on the record. There have been some concerns about some lack of clarity about the fees around the toxic-free kids and some concerns about some process issues. I think that I've been a staunch supporter of the Toxic Free Kids since we first started trying to pass this back in 2013. I know that a lot of hard work has gone into the rulemaking. I think there are a couple of areas where it can be clarified. I've had conversation with the advocates and with OHA, and I'm going to read a couple of quick things into the record that, as far as I know at this point, everybody's copacetic with. So just so you know, I've sent these to Ms. Ames, and they will be included in some form or another in the budget report. So the first is asking OHA to commit that the contracts with external consultants who are going to be doing the certification for the manufacturing control processes, that they will include provisions to allow transparency, to require transparency with the manufacturers so that they understand how the money's being spent for the certification process. The second is to ask the agency to clarify rules to streamline applications when additional chemicals are used in a given process. And that is to say, specifically, if there's information such as background information on a facility, not about the chemical itself. If a chemical is being used in a different process or in a different way, that ought to be submitted de novo. But the core background information, a company or an organization shouldn't have to submit twice. And the third is that the current process should be implemented exactly as planned. And in addition, where I would ask that the agency explore the possibility of, in the future, approving certain consultant companies of the kinds that are available as externally accredited, if you will, organizations that manufacturers could contract with independently to obtain the certification. The analogy that I've been using is if I make a lamp and I want people to know it's safe, I send it to Underwriters Laboratories, right? They test it to make sure it's safe and then accredit it. And as a consumer, then Senator Gelser knows that it's safe to buy my lamp, right? And I think that we could have a similar process. That does not mean I want any changes in the process that will be starting in 3 weeks. That needs to go forward exactly as planned. So I want to just be crystal clear about that. But I think this addresses some of the concerns that manufacturers had while still preserving the intent of the law and allowing it to proceed forward in the way that everybody's worked so hard to achieve up till now. Okay? Thanks.
All right. Madam Chair, I move the -1 amendment to House Bill 5027.
Thank you. Mr. Cochran moves the -1 amendment to House Bill 5027. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So moved.
All right. Madam Chair, I move House Bill 5027 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Mr. Cochran moves House Bill 5027 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? If not, so moved. I guess I'll take this one to full, and somebody want to take this in the House?
I can.
Okay, mm-hmm. Thank you, Representative Alonso Leon, and I'll just take it to the Senate, I guess.
Unless you wanted to.
Okay. All right.
I voted for it, if you want me to take
okay,
it.
Okay, then one of you two.
I'll give it to her.
Okay, and I'll give you something else. All right. Closing remark session.
Wait a minute.
On 5027. And I'm now going to open a public hearing. It's going to be quick, I hope. Public hearing and a work session.
I didn't put out a paper.
You didn't put out a paper.
My bad.
We can ask.
Okay, we'll just ask. I'm opening a public hearing and a work session simultaneously on Senate Bill 53 relating to licensing fees paid to the Health Authority. Ms. Ames.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, Senate Bill 53 increases licensing fees of in-home care agencies and hospice programs. The bill establishes a tiered fee structure for in-home care agencies based on the type of service provided and workload. Licensing fees for in-home care have not been changed since 07, and the hospice program licensing fees has not been changed since they were established in 2009. The budget impact of these fee increases is also included in Package 409 in the public health budget, which increases other fund expenditure limitation by $176,213.
And Senator Gelser, you heard this in your policy committee, did you not?
Yes, Madam Chair, may I?
Please.
This was a very important bill, and I know that not everyone is completely satisfied with where we landed. I think the the challenge with licensing fees is who pays them, and there's a tremendous amount of work that goes into licensing, and we are subsidizing that pretty significantly with general fund. And whether it is at a hospice or long-term care facilities or adult foster homes or foster care, it takes time, money, and people to go out and do that work. And we don't necessarily give the agencies the resources to do this. This gets us closer. I think it's a conversation that we will need to have again in the next biennium. This will allow us to do what we need to do now, but I hope moving forward we can really have a more robust conversation about what that balance is between general fund subsidization of licensing, especially for for-profit facilities, and what's paid for in a licensing fee.
Thank you. Good. Is there anybody else who'd like to offer testimony on this bill?
Cool. Mr. Co-Chair.
Oh, sorry. Representative Bueller.
The hospice program license is a pretty substantial increase from $750 to $1,140. The justification for such a big increase?
Senator Gelser, can you answer that, or should I ask the agency? Or
so we did.
I was going to have Chris from OCA to come down, maybe, because he can kind of say that they're okay with the bill.
Right. That's not hospice, though.
So, okay.
That's long-term care.
Fair enough. Got it.
Have a seat, Chris. Stay put. Okay, well, whatever. You start, and then okay. We'll get Chris.
Thank you. Yeah, so hospice did come, and hospice was in support of their part of the bill. They felt like they needed the appropriate licensing and follow through, and they actually sent somebody to the committee to testify and support the bill and these fees, which should be an OLS.
And no undue pressure was placed on them to support the budget of the certifying organization. It puts them in a difficult situation. So,
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Bueller, I don't think so, because there were others that came and opposed the fees in the bill. So they were unique for their support of the bill. And I know my contact with hospice has followed up with me a couple of times to see where the bill is.
Chris, anything else you want to offer? Please.
Co-chairs, member of the committee, my name is Chris Madden for the Oregon Healthcare Association. We represent long-term care providers, including in-home care agencies, and we're here today in support. I think that's all I have to offer.
That's helpful.
And Madam Chair?
I'm not really.
Okay. Well, cool. Yes.
If I may, I just pulled this up specifically to the question. This was from Barb Hansen from the Oregon Hospice and Palliative Care Association. She says, when I sent out notice about Senate Bill 53 to hospice leaders around the state on February 6th, I received only two comments in response. One, I think the increase seems reasonable. If the fee goes up to $1,140, that would be $3,420 for 3 years. On the year of the survey, that would be $3,420 divided by 5 days, or $684 per day. If you look at it from an hourly rate, it is $85.50 per hour, which would pay staff time, travel, and hotel costs. I think it is a reasonable amount. And the second, with the state facing a $1.4 billion deficit, we all have to adjust to increase fees. I don't see any alternative.
That's very helpful, Senator. Thank you. Senator Winters?
Sorry, I'm late.
Don't worry about it. Nice to have you here with us. Good.
Madam Chair?
Yeah.
Madam Chair, I would mention that with public health in general, we have these issues sometimes when they wait a very long time to increase a fee. Yeah. And this committee over the last couple of years has been encouraging them to do small increases more often rather than waiting for 8 years to do an increase. And then it is a big change.
Yeah. I frankly, personally think we should put fees on a six-year rolling review just like we do with tax credits. But that's a separate option. Representative Bueller?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. I mean, it's hard for people to plan, I expect, in their business when they see such a big increase year over year, as opposed to tying it to some type of metric other than it's time to do it because it's been 8 years.
Yeah. Okay. Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 53 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Co-Chair Rayfield moves Senate Bill 53 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Is there any opposition? So moved. Senator Winters, can you take this, please?
I'll take it.
You want to take it in the Senate, Senator Gelser? Thank you very much.
Representative Hayden?
Sure.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Councilor Hayden?
You got the nice one.
Closing the public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 53. And now, for the moment we've all been waiting for, I am opening a work session on House Bill 5026, the Oregon Health Authority. Ms. Ames.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, we'll go ahead and go through a number of these divisions in the order that we have them on the agenda, although it doesn't really matter, I guess. So starting with public health, which is the budget related to the two bills we just did, what you see is for each division, I have a memo that tries to highlight the highlights so that as we get to the spreadsheet, that's a lot more detailed in some divisions. We can kind of focus on what's more important, and I won't necessarily go through every little adjustment. So public health, the total funds budget is 7% lower than 15-17. That is simply an issue of the budget was right. The 17-19 budget was right-sized, but recently to take out some other fund and federal fund expenditure limitation that they did not believe they needed. The general fund budget has increased a lot, 44% or $17 million. And this is primarily for two reasons. There is new funding for the public health modernization package, and there is money to replace declining medical marijuana revenues. So on the marijuana issue, in the past, medical marijuana revenues have been used to replace general fund in a number of ongoing core public health programs, including state support for local public health, the Safe Drinking Water Program, emergency medical services, and several others. Laws passed during 15, 16, and 17 legislative sessions to implement recreational marijuana have significantly reduced revenues coming into medical marijuana. And this is partly because of growers, processors, and dispensaries moving over to OLCC to be licensed there. But they have also lost some patient licensing fees. So part of that money, the $12 million GF, will need to backfill some of that money that's been going to these other programs in order to keep them going at current levels. Package 411, Public Health Modernization, does include $5 million general fund to begin to address the public health system gaps. This is related to House Bill 2310, which we will eventually hear here, I imagine. The agency had initially requested $30 million as the 17-19 phase-in of the first phase of this work, so $5 million is a small down payment to begin that work. And then Package 409, fee changes, includes the expenditure limitation for the fees in the two bills we just talked about, plus three other fees that are just new fees in the bill. And tobacco master settlement agreement resources of $3.6 million that have been used for tobacco prevention and cessation programs has been removed from this budget in order to help fund the health plan. The proposed budget does include $16.3 million in tobacco tax resources to continue to fund the programs. And finally, there are a number of adjustments that removes general fund for several programs where the funding is not needed. There is excess ending balance. That includes the C-Care Family Planning Program, the Breast and Cervical Cancer Screening Program, and the Care Assist Program. And to be clear, the intention is not to reduce these programs or cut these services. It is simply to true up the budget. I will note that there are a number of statewide adjustments and capital construction, but we don't care about that in public health, that are not included in these recommendations, and we will expect to see adjustments for those kind of things in the end of session bill. So then if you go on to the spreadsheet, that is what we are using in lieu of the system
detail that you'll see for other agencies. You'll note, and I'll just go through a few of these. On line 3, package 70, revenue shortfalls, the way we build budgets is we put in what would have to be cut out of the budget if fees are not approved, and then they are added back in the fee package if those fees are approved. So that's a reduction of 2 staff people. Package line 5, the package 409, does add almost $2.5 million other funds limitation and removes some federal fund limitation. The 3 new fees that are in the budget that we haven't talked about yet is newborn screening fee increases and adds several tests to their array of screenings that they do. The healthcare facility construction and planning review fee is restructured into tiers and increased. Those reviews ensure that state statutory requirements are met and also that CMS requirements that are required for certification are met. And the third one is the immunization alert fee is established. This is the one to remember in our discussion. It was established years ago and then never actually used, but at this point they've lost enough donation funds and federal funding that they need to now start implementing that $5 fee. Line 6, the public health modernization, you see the $5 million we talked about, and then line 10, you see the $12.1 million that replaces medical marijuana revenues.
Excuse me.
11, 12, and 13 are the 3 programs where they just simply don't need as much general fund as they had. They have adequate fund balances. In the case of Care Assist, which is a program that helps people with HIV pay for their medical expenses. The situation there is that program receives other fund drug rebate revenues, and those are adequate to cover the program, so not all the general fund is needed. And then 14 and 15 together are the 2 pieces that impact the tobacco prevention and cessation programs that are run by public health. The tobacco master settlement money that we talked about is removed, the $3.6 million, and that will be used, you'll see, tomorrow in the health plan. At the same time, the tobacco tax forecast that's done by the Office of Economic Analysis is up for the tobacco tax resources, and so that puts that program at a 16.3 level, even after losing the 3.6 of the TMSA resources. Then down on line 17, administrative reductions, you're going to see this in all the divisions. This is a combination of cuts to services and supplies and vacancy savings. And then technical adjustments you'll also see in many of the divisions. This is agency-wide zero, so it's some movement of either limitation, funding, or sometimes positions between divisions. Package 812, vacant positions, you'll see this in every division as well. We have gone through and positions that have been vacant and are no longer needed. We worked with the agency to eliminate where we could. So in public health, we take out 17 positions. I did want to note that 6 of those are related to the medical marijuana program. As they're losing revenue, they're also paring down on staff. As growers and processors and dispensaries have moved, they don't need as many compliance staff. But it has been quite a ride for that program to try and keep their budget and their staffing at a level that makes sense when it is a constantly changing program every time we have a session. And then on line 21, the last one, package 816, this is a specific adjustment to reduce the medical marijuana budget related to the last statutory change, Senate Bill 1057, which will encourage
most growers to now shift over to OLCC, and the agency believes that they will lose about 2.7 in revenue, and that they will need to reduce their program an equivalent amount to stay and keep their budget in balance as best they can. That they add a couple positions that are needed in the short run to do some notifications, but overall they're actually eliminating 14 positions after the first year when all of this is going to actually phase in. I did want to also put on the record that this recommendation includes a cost-neutral reclassification package to true up some of their positions in that program. Since 2015, they've been given first a bunch of new positions to do a whole bunch of new work. They never quite knew what positions they needed. We haven't trued that up because the program keeps changing. And now with all these additional reductions, they felt like they could better manage their program if they changed a few of the positions around a little bit. I think that's it.
Okay, questions or comments from the committee? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Quick question on the medical marijuana revenue shortfall of $12 million added from the general fund. My understanding is there's, $68-70 million, maybe more, sitting in of recreational funds. When will that conversation be part of this budget?
Those funds, by statute, were committed to schools, pretty
all
much.
All of them?
Mm-hmm. Pretty much.
But they're stuck there, right?
No.
No?
They're Senator Winters, want to add anything?
No, but they are committed to schools, and some of them were to public safety, just.
Yeah. And so statutorily, we don't have much of an option.
And Madam Chair, there is a portion of that distribution that goes to OHA for A&D programs, and that's in the budget health systems budget. That we would talk about tomorrow.
But I thought it was hung up on some licensure stuff with OLCC, or did that get ironed out?
I don't know the answer to that question.
My general understanding is that there were no distributions made for the current biennium, and partly that's because OLCC costs had to be covered off the top before distributions were made, and that was an unknown. And the second was that the statutes were for that, in that early version of the distribution, were kind of messy, and that there was some desire to clean up those statutes before we actually did the first distributions.
So none of those funds have been
right. But they are all, both the 15-17 and the 17-19 forecasted funds, are included in budgets for 17-19.
Including the education budget?
I believe so.
I believe so.
Thank you. Statutory, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Representative Blair?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Has there been any allocation to potential legal implications of the use of dummy Social Security numbers in the C-Care program and or federal clawbacks from the use of those?
There won't be any federal clawbacks because that number was never used to bill anything, and it was only used as a placeholder, Representative. That's very clear. There was a memo from the agency detailing all that. It was resolved well over 18 months ago. It was never used to bill. It was never used outside of the agency's own system. And the federal government was well aware of it 18 months ago, and there have been no ramifications from that. So we don't anticipate any legal ramifications from that.
And can you follow?
Sure. So
what about legal implications from the person whose Social Security number was used? I hear there's investigations into that.
I don't have an answer, but perhaps the agency can help with this. But my understanding is that since that number was never used outside the system, there are unlikely to be any implications for the person whose number was inadvertently used. Ms. Saxon, can you help us out here?
I'm Lynn Saxton, the director of the Oregon Health Authority, co-chairs, members of the committee, that if there were legal charges brought, which we do not anticipate and have any no basis for thinking would occur given the Social Security Administration and CMS's determination of how that case was resolved. But if there were, we would have to provide for that out of our general legal budget for the agency. And again, we would make those accommodations within our existing budget. We would not come back and ask for additional funds for that, as we do with all administrative processes within the agency.
Sure.
How widespread was this practice of using dummy Social Security numbers within the agency? Was it just isolated to the C-Care Family Planning Program, or was it used in other programs?
We have that inquiry out in the agency right now. We'll be responding to you. Currently, we know of this setting and only, and this was at the vendor who implemented the software's recommendation. We have that document for you as well if you'd wish to review it.
And when would we have that information with regards to how widespread potentially the practice of using dummy social
media? I would expect today or tomorrow.
Okay. Thank you. You might send that information as well. I believe you sent the letter that you sent that to Ms. Ames.
Yes.
As well. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Winters.
Since this has actually come up in discussion and I think most of the caucuses in this building, it might be well advised to share that letter that came in to all members so that they're actually also know the content and what's being said.
I'm sure the agency would be happy to do that.
Yes.
Thank you. Representative Hayden?
Brief question. You mentioned that the matter was resolved. Is there more to behind that statement other than what we've been given, basically, that you quit using it?
No.
Okay. I guess I would point out that the letter made it clear that not only did they quit using it, they informed, as Ms. Saxton alluded to, they informed CMS, they informed the Social Security Administration, they clarified it all. So it wasn't as if they just stopped doing it and didn't say anything. They did all the appropriate things with the appropriate people and authorities. So it's not just like they stopped using it.
I do have a question, Madam Chair.
Sure.
And that is whether the vendor that actually made this recommendation for use, is that vendor still being used by us?
Co-Chair Senator Winters, I will look into that. I don't know that. I'm just still getting information this morning about the vendor. But again, this was at the vendor direction. It was vetted with CMS and the Social Security Administration. But I will check.
Would you? Because I think that's important.
The protocol is no longer being used.
Okay.
So.
And also you mentioned, if there is any fallout with respect to this and the individual, and I'm assuming that you're talking about we are our own risk management in the state, and so when you said come from your own budget, are you talking about within our own risk management system?
Co-Chair Senator Winters, that's correct. I do want to say that there is an ongoing basis extensive review on all levels of the organization for these kinds of administrative issues. And so in this case, this identified the problem. The problem was addressed. And we will continue to be vigilant to ensure these do not occur. But we will have the answer to your question, Representative Bueller's question, within the next day or so.
Madam Chair, just for the record, because I think it's very important, not only with this agency, but I know that the good co-chair Rayfield and we talked yesterday about IT and some of those contracts. I think it's extremely important that in our actual design and planning and the awarding of contracts and the actual contract language itself, because, we've got another one where a contract was let. And actually, I think in the agency that did not look at that, we actually had binding for infinitum with a vendor. And so these contracts that are IT contracts, I think it's the scrutiny money that needs to take place and what we're buying and what they're offering, I think, is critical for all of us, and it's not just this agency. As we move forward, you know, with IT projects with these vendors, you know, I think sometimes we're very trusting in what we're buying and not sometimes not knowing actually what the downside or the pitfalls that we're getting into.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Senator Winters, I want to underscore that the agency has made significant improvements over the course of the last several years. We have more work to do, and I would be happy to give you a briefing of where we see our current progress and our outstanding issues at your convenience. I will say that the agency was successful in recruiting, after 2 years, a business IT lead who is expert in this area, Wayne Haddad, and he's continued to make significant improvements during his tenure.
Yeah, I just to follow up, because I think it's very important. We've wrestled with this issue of IT and the design and making certain, I think, you know, as legislators, and it's been multiple. I'll just put it that. Yep. It's been multiple enough to where we actually, you know, created the position that reports directly to the governor. You know, this body has a position also to do review and to assist, because it's one that the cost of not doing this correctly has been enormous. And so I just need to put that out there, that it tends to be IT is, although it's supposed to be more efficient and more effective, that we end up having more little problems.
Thank you, Senator.
Just one last comment.
Okay, it's really germane.
Really
got to keep moving here, people.
For the record, in this one unique program, it was nearly 10,000 identities that were used, correct? I mean, the point is we're saying, okay, the problem's taken care of, we're not using it anymore, but it was 9,487 in this program, correct?
Those are total people in the program.
Those were total people for whom the dummy ID was used.
Right.
Right. But there was one dummy ID. It wasn't 9,000-something different dummy IDs.
But the dummy ID was used 9,487 times.
Right.
I want to be clear that this was a placeholder ID recommended by the vendor for use in the system. And so that protocol and the use of that protocol, as I understand the outstanding question, is whether that protocol has been used in other places in the agency. And we'll get that response to you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Mr. Co-Chair.
Madam Chair, I move the LFO recommendation to House Bill 5026.
Thank you. Mr. Co-Chair moves the LFO recommendation to House Bill 5026. Is there any further discussion? Is there any opposition? If not, so moved. Okay.
And Madam Chair, I will just note that, as the memo says, we will deal with performance measures and later when we're doing the final budget. So you'll just see that all later.
Okay. What's next?
Okay. Next is health policy and analytics. Okay, if we take a look at the memo for health policy and analytics, you'll see that the total funds budget is slightly lower than 15-17 was. Increases in other funds limitation from fees relating to the Oregon Common Credentialing System is more than offset by a reduction in federal grant funding. The general fund budget has increased by 13.4%, primarily from using general fund to replace a portion of the federal funding from the State Innovation Models grant in the Transformation Center. That funding ended September of 16. The budget includes new fees to support the cost of administering the Oregon Common Credentialing Program for an expenditure limitation of $13.8 million. There is also a $500,000 general fund, which will leverage federal funds to support Medicaid providers to connect to health information exchange entities. In 2016, federal funds became available for this purpose at a 90% match. And if you go to the spreadsheet, that is just about all there is here. So you see on line 5, the fee changes, $13.8 million. Line 9, the health information exchange onboarding funding. And then the usual administrative reductions, technical adjustments, and two positions, that vacant positions that are eliminated.
I would just say on a personal experiential level, and I'm sure that my colleagues who are also licensed health professionals can agree with this, that that common credentialing program is going to be a huge advance for everybody. That's a great example of government working in a public-private partnership to develop a system that's going to streamline credentialing on the hospital and insurance side for pretty much every licensed health professional. It's going to make a big difference.
Maybe we could have CE added to it sometime.
Oh, God, from your mouth.
That's
exactly
what I was going to say.
Yeah, it'd be nice.
It's a huge problem.
Yeah. No, it's an interesting point. Good. All right, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I move the ELICO recommendation to House Bill 5026.
Thank you. Mr. Co-Chair moves the next LFO recommendation to House Bill 5026. Is there any further discussion? Is there any opposition? If not, so moved. Next.
Next is the Oregon State Hospital. This is my favorite story of the budget. The memo points out that total funds is 5.9% higher than the 15-17 legislatively approved budget, but the general fund budget has increased only 0.6% or $2.9 million since the 15-17. And as the hospital continues to generate increasing amounts of other funds revenue through Medicare billing, the revenues have in turn been used to reduce general fund need. So this budget maintains current capacity at both Junction City and Salem campuses. So, and what that means is two wards and three cottages in Junction City will remain closed as they are today, and the cottages at Salem will remain closed. Package 410, the Oregon State Hospital improvements, includes the $40.5 million of other fund revenues that are expected to be available as a result of changes at the hospital, and that reduces general fund by $30.1 million, and it also funds 32 new positions that will continue the compliance, billing, and accreditation activities related to continuing revenue generation. This increase in Medicare funding results from the work the agency's been doing over the last 2 years to obtain certification of all hospital licensed beds with CMS and to improve billing practices to maximize these revenues.
Excellent.
Let's see if there's on the spreadsheet. I guess I would just point out that in lines 8, 9, and 10, you actually see the general fund reductions for maintaining closures of those cottages and wards that will remain closed. So remember, we are making adjustments off the current service level budget, and those were included. The full hospital being opened was included in current service level. So that's why we actually see those dollars coming out of the budget.
Thank you, Co-Chair. So just for the record and to be clear, and since I'm from Lane County, this budget is not closing any current infrastructure that is opened and working in Junction City for this biennium, correct?
That's not it.
Okay.
Correct. That is correct.
It's an important point for us.
Yeah, we understand, and there's no change in existing inpatient infrastructure between the state hospital and Junction City. No change, up or down.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gelser.
I might be slow on this, but how do we move the budget so that there is no change when we do not have the votes for a provider tax that we know that we need in order to not make the reductions?
We aren't moving the budget.
We're moving
each section of the budget today, and we're going to deal with that when we get to the provider tax tomorrow.
Okay, so by doing this, we aren't saying that it is still true that if we do not get a provider tax, we will see significant reductions at the state hospital.
Yes.
And that we
will
see
significant reductions everywhere. If we do not pass the provider tax as it is currently understood with the hospital component and the insurance and CCO component, we will have see substantial across the
board.
So
another way of putting it is maintaining the capacity at Junction City and the state hospital is entirely contingent upon a provider tax.
That is absolutely correct.
Thank you.
That is absolutely correct.
Thank you. The hydraulics of any budgeting that we do actually has an impact or implications on other areas in the budget.
Yep.
Not only would it have an implication, because when you start doing puts and takes, the question came up earlier about how the marijuana dollars were spreaded, and it spread it over, it was, you know, everything from public safety to education or whatever. This is also true with any form of additional revenue or taking away of revenue. Those impacts and implications will actually spread over, particularly those agencies that are funded by general fund, and we only have three major ones. I just need to say that because often the public does not understand the universe of budgeting. Yep. It is not just what happens in DHS or human services, but the rippling effect across this building occurs particularly in these three arenas. Because that's where the large share, I think about 95% or 96% of the dollars for general fund comes from, with those three major.
Yep.
Just so
thank you.
Know.
And may I ask one more process, because it's my
sure.
first time in Ways and Means.
So I appreciate
the,
it.
So these are the continuing service level budgets at a different point. So we're not actually approving these budgets right now. We will later. I guess I'm confused about the process of passing the budget that's not really the budget.
We're not passing the budget today. We're not taking the final vote on the budget today. We're voting the way we have these big agencies with multiple divisions. This will be true for the Department of Human Services when we get there, too. We vote on the LFO recommendations for each division separately, and then hopefully tomorrow, but we will only take the final vote on the OHA budget when we also take the vote on the provider tax. We will not take the final vote and get ready to send 5026 to Ways and Means until we vote on the provider tax. And unless the provider tax passes both this committee and full Ways and Means and the floor, the health authority budget as is currently constructed will not pass and we will not run it.
Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee, assuming that we do go ahead and pass out the provider tax bill and the budget tomorrow, obviously we don't really know if that tax will pass on the floor. Mm-hmm. So we have two options if that didn't pass in order to come back and revisit this budget. We could do it in the end of session bill, or we could bring a whole new budget bill to redo this budget through the committee.
So, and I guess just clarifying, this isn't going to land on the floor without a provider tax. That's the question.
Both of these are House, both the provider tax and this bill are House bills.
Okay.
So I cannot speak for how the Speaker will run the floor, but if I had to guess, the provider tax will run first. And if and only if the provider tax passes, then we'll see. But perhaps my co-chair can speak to that more than I, because he's a House member. Yeah, and then Representative Bueller may be waiting, so hang tight for just a sec.
Thanks for just to kind of explain the process. The idea is, I mean, we go through the divisions, adopt the recommendations for each division, make sure everybody is on board there, and then we pass the final measure, which is the basically, you know, passing the entire budget at the very end, which will then go to the full. And the idea is that we'll pass both of these out of full at the same time, which will then go to the floor, and then we'll pass them simultaneously. I mean, not simultaneously, but they'll be put on the third readings list, and we'll go through it as normal, as part of an overall plan to move forward. But I think the idea is, you know, from the very beginning that we wanted to solve the healthcare hole within healthcare, and so that's what we had the work group that you know, four of us at least on this committee sat through and went through, and so that was kind of the idea behind this at least. So in the order of one passing the other, I don't, it's not necessarily going to matter as long as they both pass in the grand scheme of things. So
yeah, Representative Bueller, thank you for your patience.
Thank you. Madam Chair, why doesn't the provider tax go to House Revenue Committee?
It was in House Revenue Committee originally, and it got sent here to Ways and Means. I can't speak to House process, quick. Representative. I'm sorry. Representative Hayden?
Thank you. Quick procedural question. It's now 8:09, almost 9:30 on Wednesday, and we're proposing a vote on arguably the largest budget in our general fund. Once it's matched with federal dollars, education is separate from that. So a very large budget. And when will we have access to even be able to read the provider tax proposal?
That's a very good question. We're hoping soon.
I mean, we're less than 24 hours away without a bill.
And Representative, you have been involved in conversations. Yes. I have been meetings with you. We've been meeting for months about this exact same issue. You are aware of the details. You know that we are actually drafting, the final amendments on these things. So I don't have the next amendment, I cannot speak.
And folks, I get that people are concerned about this, but we also have other things we have to get done today. The provider tax conversation will or will not happen tomorrow. And so I'd really like, unless it's urgent for us to have a further conversation about this today, I'd like us to keep moving on the things that are actually on our agenda. Okay?
Madam Chair, I have one more thing to put on the record. The recommendation for the state hospital does include a cost-neutral reclassification of positions. This is to align the staffing plan that's actually being used today with the, official position system. This has not been adjusted since each of the two facilities opened.
Okay. I have a question. Senator Gelser?
Sure. So under the other recommended adjustments, there is a reduced coverage of collaborative problem solving of about $4.2 million in 13 positions. My understanding from presentations that we've had both in the SACU Task Force and Human Services Committee is that has significantly reduced staff and patient injury at the state hospital. What will the impact be of...
Madam Chair, Senator Gelser, this does maintain their base funding of 3.9, and what the hospital has said is they have been able to move somewhat to a train-the-trainer model. They have found ways to move this forward in the program without the additional funding, and they believe that they will be able to still do what they need to do on that training because it is a priority for them.
And then just follow up. Is there a way, again, whether it's a performance measure or a budget note, to pay attention to that? The impact of this for patients is significant in terms of injury and in terms of reduction of use of seclusion and restraint. It's a pretty significant human rights issue, and I'm wondering how we can maintain
that
investment.
I think injuries is a KPM.
And seclusion and restraint, is that?
Madam Chair, those are not official KPMs in the key performance measure system. But they do track them and they report them each session.
Could we add those? Because I would hate for us to get 2 years out and all of a sudden have more injuries and more secluded, restrained people.
Madam Chair, can I suggest, because we're right now on budget and you're talking some other stuff, and can I suggest that this particular conversation, because the restraint issue, the safety of both patient as well as employees have been on this radar screen of this budget committee for infinitum. So can we have a group that works on this with Gelcher so that you can move your budget along?
Yeah, and my concern is that number. It is a budget number. I'm not comfortable supporting reducing collaborative problem solving without it.
But to be clear, Senator, I hear you loud and clear, but we have been in close conversation with the state hospital about this. This was additional funding that was going to be available if it was needed, if they hadn't made as much progress as they already had. So that's why it was in their CSL budget. But they felt like they made more progress than they anticipated. And as Ms. Ames said, they're doing a lot more train-the-trainer. They believe that it's sustainable in its current form, and they don't anticipate any backsliding. I agree. We need to pay attention, and it has been beneficial to everybody. Every single person who spends time at the state hospital has benefited from this program, and everybody recognizes that. So there's no intention to backslide on that. And we absolutely do track staff injuries, seclusion and restraint. All
client
those
injuries. I'm more concerned about the client injuries.
Okay, I'm concerned about both. And I hear you loud and clear, but I don't think anybody thinks that it's a good idea to go back to the way we were. And haven't heard anything from the state hospital that suggests that that would happen. I'm happy to have a further conversation with you about it. I think it's going to be a little late in the game to add another KPM, but we can certainly have a conversation and perhaps include something in the budget report that expresses a concern about this and asks them to continue to keep us posted. How about that for a plan?
That would be helpful. And I apologize. This was just a surprise to me. We didn't hear about this in the hearings, and that it's just a surprise to see it there. It's a big deal.
Thank you.
The Director Saxon's happy to talk if you want, or we can just...
I think we're good for now, and we'll just plan on putting just a couple of sentences maybe in a budget report that addresses your concern, and that will be important, and that'll help us stay posted on it.
Okay. So with that, Madam Chair, I move the LFO recommendation to House Bill 5026 with respect to the Oregon Hospital.
Thank you. Mr. Co-Chair moves the LFO recommendation with respect to the Oregon State Hospital for House Bill 5026. Is there any further discussion? Is there any opposition? It's up to you, Senator. You get to choose. Okay.
Yeah, I do. I have concerns.
Please note that Senator Gelser is opposed. Motion carries. All right, next.
Madam Chair, the next division is the overall administrative costs. It includes central services, shared services, and statewide assessments and enterprise-wide costs. This section of the budget, total funds, is 20% lower than 15-17, but this is really for a goofy reason. There was some bond refunding that was done in 15-17, and there always has to be a bunch of limitation put into the budget to do that. And it saves you money in the long run for your debt service. But so in other funds limited, you see in 15-17, there's that $129 million. So that artificially skews the budget. Without that, the total funds increase would be just under 2%. The general fund budget has increased 3.2% or $6.8 million. This is primarily because of the cost allocation issues that were identified in the 15-17 biennium and primarily due from bringing the state hospital into the cost allocation plan. And we've seen those cost allocation adjustments in the current biennium, both in the recent rebalance and in the December 16 rebalance. This section of the budget does include $69.7 million general fund for debt service and a little bit of federal funds that was related to building the state hospital. In total, a total of $27.9 million general fund is added to address cost allocation issues. This relates to the funding of state government service charges, enterprise technology services, shared services, and central services. I will note that for these cost allocation issues that are specific to shared services, there are some savings that accrues to the DHS budget as OHA picks up more of the general fund need. The IT project that we heard about earlier, integrated eligibility, is not included in this budget. We anticipate that because there is bond funding involved, that decision will be made fairly late and that it will be included in the end of session bill if it's included. And if you go to the spreadsheet, there's a couple things here that aren't getting specific note. On line 8, there is $858,000 general fund added for the Regional Health Equity Coalition. In the current biennium, this was partially funded with the federal SIM grant that went away in September. So this is just continuing that program. This coalition works with community organizations, CCOs, and health systems to promote health equity. There are 6 of these coalitions, 5 of them in rural and underserved areas. They cover a total of 11 counties in the Warm Springs tribe. That program considered this to be a very important And then as you go down through lines 10, 11, 12, 13, that's where you see your cost allocation issues. There is a small savings relating to risk charges and facilities. Line 14, ISPO moved to DAS. Sorry about all the acronyms. It's hard to get descriptions in when you only get a tiny space like this. ISPO is the Information Security and Privacy Office in OHA. And four positions are moving out of OHA over to the state CIO's office. This is happening in a number of agencies. The state CIO believes it will be more effective to do some of this security work at a statewide central level. Line 16, just a reminder that what's happening in DHS sometimes affects this budget. There's a savings of $684,000 general fund as a result of vacancy savings in DHS's shared services. And then the usual administrative reductions, and line 19, eliminating of four positions. And finally on line 20, there's a small shared service component to that Senate Bill 1057 relating to medical marijuana.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I move the LFO recommendations to House Bill 5026.
Representative Co-Chair Rayfield moves the LFO recommendations to House Bill 5026. Representative Buehler?
Yes, thank you, Chair. So I know it's a small item, small line item, but I don't know where it's going to show up here. But I have serious concerns about the Fairfield Trust and the $6 million.
Fairview Trust
and the $6 million that, at least in the governor's budget, was going to be swept from the account.
Not being swept. Okay. Comes up tomorrow. Does that help?
That's all.
Thank you.
A quick question on this.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair. On the LFO, it tells us what it would be without the fuzzy math, but it doesn't tell us what it actually is. Why is that?
On the LFO,
it says without the total funds increase, this would be, it talks about, this is because the bond funding limitation is included in 2015-17 without that being included. Mm-hmm. So
basically, maybe Zanes can probably give a better explanation than I.
Yeah, I was just trying to show you what the percentage increase would be between the biennia if you didn't have that $129 million in 15-17. The 17-19 total numbers are correct.
Okay, so the question is, if you do have it, what is the increase?
20.4%.
But it's a one-time
cost. It's a decrease, though. It's 20. With that included in 15-17, then it looks like 17-19's total budget has declined significantly. But it really hasn't. That was all I was trying to say. It's just an artificial construct of that limitation being put into 15-17.
Trying to give the committee more accurate.
We're really just sort of doing things the same as we did them last biennium.
Okay.
It's just transparency about where that extra money was for, what that extra money is for. Okay. Any further discussion? Is there any opposition to the motion? If not, so moved. Excellent. We're making progress. What's next, Peb?
Okay, Madam Chair, then the next is PAB and OEB, and these are constructed in basically the same way. So these budgets are worked a little differently. So you have your memo at the front that just indicates that PAB expenditure growth is capped at 3.4%, as it has been the last couple biennia. $12 million other funds expenditure limitation has been added to pay the 1.5% insurer tax, assuming that is part of the final plan, but at this point it is. But if you go to the second page in the packet, this is a display that shows you how the limitation need is actually calculated to be sure that we're at the 3.4%. So you'll see the PEPM rate is the per employee per member rate per month. That's per month. So in 2016, you see that was at $1,350. That's the last actual data point we have. 17, 18, and 19 are then calculated at the 3.4% increase on a PEPM basis. And that core program portion of their budget is then calculated based on capping it at 3.4. And then you'll see there's a couple, there's in this budget, three things we add after that that are not considered part of that core program. There's the insurer tax at $12 million, which is badly formatted. And there's optional insurance, which is like life insurance and disability insurance, but that where members pay the full cost themselves. So while this usually grows at a slower rate than 3.4, it's not actually part of that cap. And then finally, PEB operations, actually their people and running their program is $10 million, and that's added on at the bottom as well. So you see the $1.966 billion is then the number that you also see on the memo and the spreadsheet below. And this is just the background that shows you how we actually get to that bottom line and how it restricts the budget to 3.4. Part of the trouble with these budgets, and since we're going off of current service level, in this case, current service level was developed a year ago, and we didn't have that last actual data point, and so it's trued up to the most recent information in this way.
Okay. Anything else we need to look at on the sheet?
No. We're good.
Okay. Mr. Cochair?
Madam Chair, I move the LFO recommendation to House Bill 5026.
Mr. Co-Chair moves the LFO recommendation for House Bill 5026. Is there any discussion, Representative Bueller?
Yeah, I'll be voting no on these next two, both PEB and OEB. I think there's a marked cost savings to be had here, and I don't feel comfortable with these budgets, nor do I feel very confident in the level of discussion or investigation with regards to what we can do to control the cost in both.
Thanks for adding that point. Appreciate it. I know that there's some significant issues around this in the cost containment bill, Senate Bill 1067.
And since this individual's on cost containment, is along with Greg Smith and another bipartisan group that has dug deep into this particular issue and have come up with what we hope will be some proposals that will pass through this chamber, which I'm sure that it's another one of those very contentious issues that people will either have to hold their nose and cough and what have you, but the reality of it is of where we are in this building for 2017, it's going to be very painful in a lot of areas.
And I appreciate the work that all of you are putting on. Representative Hayden?
A quick question on achieving the 3.4. I see we've got 3.4 kind of above the line, and then, oh, but we're going to take a few other things out of it. But is there any reserves calculated in use, not necessarily increase in funds budget, but existing pockets of money that are available that are used to achieve that 3.4 internally?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, so with this budget and, well, there's two things going on right now. The agency has been working with providers and their actuarial team to get 2018 contracts, and that will ultimately affect some of this, and they have approved some things that will help them to stay within the 3.4. The reserves at this point, assuming they stay within their 3.4 over 17-19, is right about at the targeted reserve amount that the actuaries recommend for the self-insured portion of PEB. And you'll remember in May 1st, they did transfer $120 million of the reserves over to the general fund. At this point, I forget exactly what the reserves, but it may be $150 million. That's their target. It's somewhere in that range. There is significant money in that stabilization fund. And this budget does not assume that we will use that. It assumes they will stay within the 3.4, which is what they will get as more or less from premiums from agencies. So that would allow their stabilization fund to stay steady.
So thank you. I appreciate that explanation. And if we go back in history, I, to my satisfaction, have not seen actuarially that we've been able to achieve the 3.4 once you take reserves into account. And we don't have finalized contracts, so I will also oppose this until we actually have it buttoned down to be a true 3.4.
Okay. Any further discussion?
That's why
all right, I see opposition from Representative Hayden, Representative Buehler. Any other opposition? Okay. So moved. OWEB?
And finally, OWEB. That budget is also capped at 3.4% per employee per year. And again, there is the worksheet that shows you the percentage change per year in this history of actuals. You will see that in this program, cost increases have been significantly under 3.4%. This program is structured quite differently than PEB, as you'll remember from the public hearings, in that there are more options for high deductible program or policies that cost less, and there are other things outside of the specific insurance program that OEB doesn't necessarily even have data on, such as some school districts offer health services accounts. HSAs. And so there's some of those things going on, which has helped OEB to keep their increases very low. Again, though, they are capped for 17, 18, and 19 at the 3.4%. Optionals is then added, and their operational cost of $11.3 million is added on top as well.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
I have, Madam Chair, move the LFO recommendation to House Bill 5026.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Moves the House LFO recommendation to House Bill 5026. Discussion? Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Co-Chair. So my concern with this one, which I'll be opposed to, very strongly supportive of our teachers, but particularly our small schools are struggling to achieve this in their budgets when the alternative option would be for allowing more flexibilities or options to those school boards to either purchase on the private market or enter into the exchange where they could get significant federal assistance in providing health care insurance for some of their employees. So I'll oppose it because they don't currently, not all of them, some of them are exempt from prior legislation, but there's too little flexibility for our small schools to make this work.
Appreciate your concern. Thank you. Any further, Representative Buehler?
I'll be a no also. I think, again, there's market efficiencies and cost reductions that can be achieved here, and I don't think we have upheld the spirit of the initial healthcare transformation in order to move OEB specifically into the exchange and the expectations that would help stabilize the small and individual market.
I think we're definitely looking at a wide range of options around PEB and OEB, and I look forward to continuing to understand the work that the cost containment group's been doing and whether options remain available to us. Good. Any further discussion? Any opposition besides Representative Hayden or Representative Buehler? Okay. So moved. Nicely done, team. We are done for today.
Our agenda tomorrow is...
Our agenda tomorrow, Ms. Ames?
Madam Chair, as you know, we're waiting for an amendment for House Bill 2391. If we have that amendment in a reasonable, timely way, we will proceed with that bill, with House Bill 3398, and with the rest of the OHA budget, including taking the final action and go through the KPMs.
Madam Chair, just and before you adjourn, and I just want to both commend you and Representative Rayfield. You know, I had to do this in 2003 and 2005. and unless individuals sit where the two of you are sitting to work with LFO, it will become very painful before we actually get through this process in this building. And I need to put that out there because there are those who think that somehow there is mana out there outside this building. There is not. And the process that you're going through occurs in budget, and this, you happen to be the individuals who have the task of saying no. You happen to be the individuals who, when all of the groups come and say, mine is more important than this one over here, that you're going to be bombarded with. And you are. I just need to tell you that in case you haven't already. Because everything is everybody, the stakeholders, it's all their priorities. But the reality is, unlike the federal government, Oregon, by constitution, cannot borrow their way out of this issue. You must balance the budget. So I just needed to say that. I know how hard it is for the two of you. Everybody comes in here with their favorite program and their favorite piece that they support and what have you. And this process, before we adjourn, will be one that will actually make you sleepless at night.
Yes, ma'am.
So I want to commend the two of you, having been there, and know the hill that your two of you are going to have to climb in getting these budgets through. And it's not just the House. You're going to have to get it through both chambers and get it to where the governor's going to sign it. So just need to say that for you because you've got more work to do besides today. So I'm...
Thank you, Matt. Thank you very much, Senator. I appreciate your kind words. And you're right. And Ms. Ames, help me out on procedure. Do I... Because we're already posted for work session tomorrow, can I close the work session?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't want to close it and screw it up. Closing the work session on 5026 for today. We'll be having a new one tomorrow. Anything else for the good of the order? Back here tomorrow, folks. See you then.
I'm so confused.